Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We are broadcasting from the Los Angeles Times Book Festival on the campus of the University of Southern California, and we will begin with the issue of the day following the bombings in Boston and the possibility that they may be blowback from the war on terror. Mark Mazzetti, a national security correspondent for the New York Times and author of the explosive new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth, joins us. In 2009, he shared a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on the intensifying violence in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Washington's response. And the previous year, he was a Pulitzer finalist for reporting on the CIA's detention and interrogation programs. Then we'll examine how cell phones are threatening our closest living relatives, the great apes, with Craig Sanford, who is the co-director of the Jane Goodall Research Center at USC. His latest book, Planet Without Apes, is about a tragic extinction that does not have to happen. The four living great apes are all precariously close to disappearing from the Earth under threats from forest loss, emerging diseases, and the demand for coltan in electronic gadgetry. We'll discuss solutions that can help save the apes' existence on Earth into at least the next century. Then finally, we will speak with Kathleen Sharp about her book, Blood Medicine, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. We will look into the power of Big Pharma in a ruthless pursuit of corporate profit at the expense of innocent patients, and the role, or lack thereof, of the Justice Department, whose current head is a former partner in the law firm who defended the villain in Blood Medicine, Johnson & Johnson. So, welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Mazzetti. And obviously, I would like to get into the whole issue of your book and how the line between the soldier and the spy has been blurred and how the CIA has gotten back into the killing business. But let's just touch on Boston, since it's obviously on everybody's mind. It looks as if the Russian FSB sent a dossier or something relating to the older brother of these two brothers who were accused of doing this bombing. And they sent it to the CIA, and then they in turn passed it on to the FBI. And somehow did the FBI drop the ball?
Well, the FBI is being accused right now of dropping the ball, and I think we don't know enough about what they looked into and what they may have found or not found, what the Russians initially had on the brother. It's certainly in the Russians' interest right now to be bragging a bit, right, about they were on the case and they, you know, having a surveillance net over Chechnya and other provinces. And so I think we don't know if anyone dropped the ball at this point. It would be too early to make those conclusions. But clearly there was there are some leads to follow. There was the trip, the overseas trip the brother took. There was the dossier. So we'll keep trying to report that.
And do you think that there's any evidence that he had any training, any jihadi training in that very troubled area between Dagestan, Chechnya?
Not that I've heard of yet, and they, this is still something they are just now trying to look into. I have not heard yet of any training, and some of my colleagues are also trying to report on the story, and, that would obviously be a pretty significant development if this is someone who went overseas to get trained and then came back, or is it just someone who clearly became radicalized, had plenty of ways to learn how to build bombs and sort of was radicalized by the internet and did this with his brother, and whether he was told to do it or not is really the big question.
Well, we have a precedent, though, in the Times Square bomber. He apparently went back to Pakistan, learned how to build the pressure cooker bombs, and fortunately was incompetent and put 120 firecrackers in there instead of some serious explosives.
And that's an interesting case because, you have, as you said, he took the trip to Pakistan. There did seem to have been some contact with Pakistani militant groups. He was unsuccessful, and very interestingly, when he was brought into court after the failed bombing, made a statement about how he had become radicalized in part by, the drone program in Pakistan, and that was sort of the primary reason why he had tried to carry out this attack.
So is it possible that there will be, I mentioned blowback in the opening, is it possible that that this may be a harbinger of things to come, that we may be seeing more of this in the coming decade of asymmetrical warfare on our soil in payback for people who've been droned. I understand that it creates it's a huge helpless rage in people in places like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen. And how much do you think that there may be this, it's called blowback, in other words?
It's certainly possible that we're just seeing the beginning of this. My guess is that the CIA is starting to seriously examine, if their analysts are trying to examine whether the operations side of the CIA is having this impact on radicalization. Now, is it radicalization in the areas where the drones are happening, and then people will go out from these areas and try to attack the United States itself or American interests? Or is it just people watching these reports of strikes and are inside the country and become radicalized that way? There's videos that they can watch on YouTube, and there's all sorts of evidences of some of these strikes going badly. Those are two different things to worry about, but they're both worrying.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Mazzetti, who's a national security correspondent for the New York Times and author of the explosive new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and the War at the Ends of the Earth. In 2009, he shared a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on the intensifying violence in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Washington's response. And the previous year, he was a Pulitzer finalist for reporting on the CIA's detention and interrogation program. Now, Mark, one of the ways that I got a sense of how the lines are being blurred between soldiers and spies was actually from the secret recording that Bob Woodward got from, I don't know where he got it from, but it was released in the Washington Post in the style section of all places, where it was a solicitation by an emissary of Fox News on behalf of Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch to General Petraeus before he took the CIA job, basically saying, you know, we'll give you a blank check if you run for president. We'll, you know, Roger will take a leave of absence. Rupert will finance it. And you can see that Petraeus is very uncomfortable in this conversation. And he basically says, and this woman, Casey McFarland, says, you know, don't take the Joint Chiefs job. You know, just, you know, be a candidate and we can beat Obama, you know. Petraeus demurs and says, look, I'm not interested in the Joint Chiefs job. I'm really interested in the other agency. That's where the future's going to be. That's where all the action's going to be. So what was he saying? What was he thinking? What was attractive to this storied general to join the CIA without getting into what happened to him once he joined?
Well, yeah, right, exactly. If you look at Petraeus's career, he had risen to fame by taking charge of the two big wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and got to be a 4-star general. And what we're seeing increasingly is a movement away from the big wars because of the budget cuts, because the war in Iraq is ended from the U.S. side. They're trying to draw down in Afghanistan. The public is very wary of these big costly engagements. And maybe what Petraeus was saying was, well, what the CIA does business, which is in shadows and with drones, with smaller scale operations, that this is the sort of way of war for the future. And the CIA it wasn't unique that a 4-star general would go take over the CIA. That's happened before, but clearly it's a fundamentally changed place from where it was on September 11th, 2001.
And is there one of the reasons why it's changed? Is it just so much money was thrown at them after 9/11?
It was money. It was authorities. They had, shortly after 9/11, President Bush gave the CIA this sort of sweeping mandate to go around the world, basically, and capture and kill. And the CIA had been out of the killing business for for the most part, for a few decades since the Church Committee investigations of the 70s that revealed all the coup attempts and assassination plots that the CIA had done in its early decades. And then 9/11 happens. And even before 9/11, you had the CIA really wrestling with this idea of the predator. They had this new technology. Should the CIA be in charge of killing Osama bin Laden or his followers? And there was this sort of morality play going on where the agency was very concerned about being in assassination business. So then 9/11 happens, and they get these new authorities, they get the budgets, they get increased numbers, and they sort of take the lead in these wars.
And Mark Mazzetti, in your new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth, it deals a lot with the rivalry between, or the friction, if you will, between the Department of Defense and the CIA, which there's nothing new about that. But how much is that exacerbated, again, by the notion of so much money being thrown around, that you have this group called JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command? And my understanding is that they really, they throw money around in an extraordinary way, and they may not have the kind of training and discipline that the CIA had. And of course, they're in the business of bribing foreign officials to spy against their own countries. That's been their mandate from the beginning. So how much are they, in a sense, stepping on each other's toes, recruiting the same assets, etc.?
Well, what you saw after 9/11 was, Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, saw the army that he had, the military he had, and he saw them as basically totally ill-equipped to fight the kind of war he envisioned, which was this global war. It was war where soldiers had to go where they couldn't normally go. So he first of all tried to expand the authorities the Pentagon had to send troops places. And I recount in the book, he took this trip down to Fort Bragg a couple months after 9/11, and he sort of saw JSOC's capabilities, and he sort of, a light went off in his head about how he could use this force as his sort of global Praetorian guard in a way to go and carry out these not only intelligence gathering missions but also killing missions. But at the time, JSOC was really this small niche force. They did hostage rescues. They couldn't sort of carry out operations for more than 24 or 48 hours at a time. What they did over the years was build up the capabilities to allow them to basically run entire little wars. So whether it be in Yemen or parts of Iraq, JSOC has really been very prominent. And so you'll see this going on now where in Yemen, for instance, JSOC runs a drone campaign, so does the CIA. There's a redundancy that goes on, and they have sort of separate sort of lists of people they go after, and there's so much blurring that it's hard for me as a reporter, for people in the media, to figure out exactly, well, why does the U.S. have two parallel drone campaigns in Yemen?
And they're operating out of Djibouti, is that...
So the JSOC program has been operating out of Djibouti and Ethiopia. The CIA portion sort of really started ramping up in 2011, and they built a base in Saudi Arabia to run the CIA drone flights.
So, Mark Mazzetti, just following through though on the money, because I think it's a big aspect of it. We sort of went willy nilly into this war on terror. And the recent report on torture indicates that we sort of sought revenge, and in doing so violated human rights in order to exact our revenge. And that was a bipartisan report. But one of the extraordinary chapters in your book is about how this guy Furlong, and this contractor in the Department of Defense, basically grabbed hold of a program and ran with it, and brought in Dewey Claridge, one of the Iran-Contra figures. And it sort of indicates to me that's just a sort of, if you will, the tip of the iceberg in terms of the enormous amount of money that's poured in this parallel universe. The defense budget is big enough on its own, but you've got this parallel universe with contractors. And it's also worth noting that the CIA has the same, with people like Kofa Black are working for Blackwater as well.
The Pentagon, and I mean, and the Pentagon budget dwarfs the CIA's budget if you're just looking at the CIA, not the entire intelligence budget. So there's so much money that does slosh through the Pentagon. So I use the sort of figure of Michael Furlong as someone who was a career former officer and then became a civilian bureaucrat and very smart and sort of knew the system. So he knew where the money was parked and he knew where to get money. And he was very sort of leaned forward in the sense of trying to do intelligence collecting operations, information operations. And so what happens is you have this fight between the Pentagon and the CIA in Afghanistan during 2008 and 2009. And the top general in Afghanistan at the time, General McKiernan, has this bitter relationship with the CIA station chief. He doesn't trust the CIA. He thinks the CIA is only hand-fed information by Pakistani spies, and so his troops are dying, so he's looking for intelligence elsewhere. So enter Furlong, who has money to then sort of enlist Dewey Claridge and others to gather information around Afghanistan and Pakistan. It was a sort of private spy network, and this was run through a Pentagon contract. It made small amounts of money by Pentagon standards, but I think it's illuminating of, you know, just how you can get things done if you know where to go and, you know the places where the money comes from. I mean, basically, Furlong did that.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Mazzetti, the author of the explosive new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and War at the Ends of the Earth. In 2009, he shared the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on intensifying violence in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Washington's response. And the previous year, he was a Pulitzer finalist for reporting on the CIA's detention and interrogation program. So let's turn to Pakistan and the story of Raymond Davis, which you begin your book with. And again, we're speaking here live from the LA Times Book Festival on the campus of the University of Southern California. Now, Raymond Davis, he was a contractor, was he not?
He was a contractor, former Green Beret, who then left the military and became a contractor for the CIA.
And you're suggesting that he almost single-handedly torpedoed U.S.-Pakistan relations.
Well, I wouldn't want to overstate that, but I think that, you know, what it was interesting. I went to Pakistan last year to do reporting for the book, and, you know, the Davis episode was so pretty much forgotten in the United States. It was an interesting blip, and then the Bin Laden raid happened, and everyone remembers that. But when you go to Pakistan, I mean, the Raymond Davis matter is so central to people's thinking, because it seemed to confirm people's conspiracies about, you know, what the CIA was up to. And here you had a guy who shot two people in Lahore who he thought were trying to rob him, and a third person gets killed when an American truck tries to rescue Davis. It's a complete mess, and he ends up in jail. And so there's this big fight between inside the Obama administration about whether to tell the Pakistanis he was working for the CIA or to maintain he's a diplomat. They initially maintain he's a diplomat. Eventually, they have to come clean to the Pakistanis, say he's a spy, and they get him out of the country. So the reason why I think it's so significant is that it sort of fostered so much more bitterness inside Pakistan. Ray Davis kind of became the boogeyman where I actually attended this rally last summer where the head of a militant group called Lashkar-e-Taiba was invoking the name Raymond Davis as the sort of symbol of all that America is doing inside of Pakistan.
Well, at the time when Kerry and I think it was Kerry Lugar that were putting together an enormous aid bill to Pakistan, the Pakistani press was full of stuff about Blackwater and all this stuff. So it sounds like he basically was a gift to all of those Pakistani conspiracy theories.
There are a few places on earth more conspiratorial than Pakistan, and sometimes even in Pakistan, conspiracies are right. I mean, you're right. I mean, so you had this aid budget, this aid money, and all of these Americans were coming to Pakistan, some for quite legitimate reasons to administer aid money, but there were dozens and dozens of visas being issued by the Pakistani embassy in Washington. Some were coming from the CIA, some were coming from the DOD, some were coming from the State Department, but they all said State Department on them. And so even, as I write in the book, even the American embassy in Islamabad didn't have real clear records on who was doing what inside the country.
So you mentioned the Bin Laden raid, and subsequent movie was made about it. Of course, a lot of controversy emerged out of the portrayal of torture in that movie, Zero Dark Thirty. One of the things I find it extraordinary, and maybe you can shed some light on this, is there a sort of war going on within the CIA over the torture legacy? You know, there's a 6,000-page report that the Senate Select Intelligence Committee did based on classified documents. The report that just came out about a week ago on the legacy of torture didn't have access to classified material, although it was very damning in its findings, both in Bush and Cheney for crossing the line, and for Obama for looking forward, not looking backwards, and not prosecuting anybody. But there's a possibility that that 6,000-page report may be released. But you've got people like Rodriguez in the CIA. And one of the things that a former CIA fellow, a friend of mine, Bob Baer, said, that he finds that what happened to the CIA in the war on terror was completely brain dead, that they put a lot of these guys who were formerly, going against Castro in Cuba, who were, of Latino descent, put them in charge of the Middle East and Arabic affairs. So is there two groups in the agency, those that like Glenn Carl and others who say torture was a catastrophe, and those that have gone public and said how great it was and how it worked in takes of Rodriguez? And of course, it's worth remembering that both former President Bush and Vice President Cheney also, in a sense, I don't know whether they're proud of what they did, but they certainly are not apologetic about what they did.
The CIA is certainly not uniform in its views on the interrogation program. You see divisions within the agency. A lot of them are, one of the things I spent a lot of time talking about in the book is the growth of the counterterrorism center in the CIA, which used to be the sort of obscure small part of the agency, which really became the beating heart of the agency. First in the detention interrogation program, and then secondly through the drone strikes. Jose Rodriguez once ran that. And so when you ask about the legacy, there is a fight over this in Senate report. I think that the CIA is trying to, elements within the CIA are trying to push back on this forthcoming Senate report because they're trying to protect that legacy. Others in the agency are actually quite ashamed of the program and think it was the worst thing that the CIA ever got involved in. And so, now the new CIA director, John Brennan, who is a former CIA officer and then worked for Obama for 4 years, he's going out there and has this very interesting problem and job ahead of him of either defending parts of the agency, but also not trying to keep this classified thing from coming out. It's a really big predicament for him.
Well, just in the last minute then, can you give us a sense of where you think we're heading? We talked earlier about how this bombing in Boston may be the harbinger of a new bout of asymmetrical warfare and a sort of blowback from the drone programs and strikes abroad and from the sense of outrage against the United States that all these boots on the ground. Of course, the reason we have drones is we don't want boots on the ground. But, it's almost like the third law of thermodynamics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
It's certainly, we're just going to begin to see what the implications of this type of warfare is for a long time to come. I think the agency may try to get out of this paramilitary business, but it's going to be hard to see them get entirely out of it. So I think it's going to be this way for a while.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
At the LA Times Book Festival, Mark Mazzetti. Again, Mark Mazzetti is the author of the explosive new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. He's a national security correspondent for the New York Times and shared the Pulitzer Prize for reporting in 2009 and the previous year was a Pulitzer finalist for reporting on the CIA's detention and interrogation programs. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how our cell phones are threatening our closest living relatives. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Craig Stanford, who is a well-known authority on the behavior of primates and other animals and on the biological and cultural roots of human behavior. He's a professor of anthropology and biological sciences at USC and director of the USC Jane Goodall Research Center. He's also the author of a new book, Planet Without Apes. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank you, Ian.
Craig Stanford. Now, Planet Without Apes, the idea that our addiction to cell phones and electronics is causing or contributing to the extinction of these noble creatures, the great apes, our closest relatives in the animal kingdom. Give me a sense of how that case is made.
Well, you know, my view as an ecologist is that we're living in the 21st century in the great bottleneck in terms of ecosystems. So in the 19th century, North America, the U.S. and Canada went through the same bottleneck. We nearly lost all of our wildlife, the big animals, the bison, the wolf, the grizzly. We managed to save them by the skin of their teeth. And into the 20th and 21st century, we've managed to set up sustainable long-term plans for their survival. So the developing world is in the same situation now for many of their majestic animals. And my own work for many, many years has been with the great apes, the gorilla, the chimpanzee, bonobo, and orangutan. And so in Africa, you have a situation now where you have rapid deforestation, people eating great apes as part of their diet for the table.
Is that what they call bushmeat?
The bushmeat crisis, exactly, is what refers to. It's actually a term that Americans, for whatever reason, have never really picked up on. That most audiences I speak to in the U.S., people still don't know that word bushmeat. People in Europe tend to be more familiar with it. It's actually derived from the French translation of it. And it simply refers to the fact that people in some parts of the world still eat wild animals as a source of protein. And in Africa, that's been going on for thousands of years. It's sustainable. It had been sustainable. It's not sustainable in the 21st century because it's become industrialized. It's become a commercial industry. It's become a global smuggling network in which the meat of great apes is taken and it's smuggled out of the forest where they live, usually via logging trucks and whatnot. It ends up in towns and cities where it's sold at enormous prices, 10 times the cost of beef. And from there, it goes onto a global smuggling route that takes it to Paris, London, Brussels, and even to New York City.
And I've seen footage of, I guess they're from the Congo, I think it was, or maybe Rwanda, going deep into the jungle and cornering gorillas.
Right.
And killing them. I mean, it's hard to believe that a group of men can do this, but they do. And you hear this beautiful creature screaming. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not an aggressive animal to begin with, my understanding.
Right. No,
and apparently, is it for bushmeat? Is that why they're killing gorillas?
Yeah, people have been doing that. I mean, it sounds gruesome and awful. It's been done for thousands of years. And it was actually sustainable for a long time because it was mainly a man going out with a spear trying to find some food for his children to eat. Mm-hmm. And it's dangerous because you can easily be killed by a large silverback gorilla. Is a very peaceful animal, but when provoked, or when the members of his group are provoked, he can be deadly.
Oh, sure.
He weighs 400 pounds. So that was actually sustainable. It was a difficult thing to do. It didn't happen very often. But the advent of guns changed the equation. And then the advent of large-scale logging operations where trucks would go deep into the forest to carry timber out. And those became pipelines, those logging roads, for the commercial trade in the meat. So it's no longer a local practice. As a local practice, it really is sustainable. And there's a lot of, you know, I think there's a lot of kind of tinge with racism feeling about what goes on in places like Africa. We feel like, oh, they just don't know what they're doing in terms of protecting their natural heritage. And we forget that it was a century ago that we did exactly the same thing in North America. So we have to work with these cultures. We try to change their dietary tastes away from these delicacies. And it really is a delicacy. For many African societies, West and Central Africa, eating a gorilla is comparable to us wanting lobster caviar. You serve it to your guests at a fancy dinner party. You serve it at a banquet. So it's a difficult cultural practice to change. It'd be like telling Americans no more turkey on Thanksgiving. And so we work with that. We have a lot of grassroots programs across Africa working on this problem, but it is a difficult problem. And the biggest The biggest problem with it is not only the large-scale hunting, but the fact that these animals reproduce very, very slowly, more slowly than we do. So they cannot sustain that level of hunting.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Stanford, who is the co-director of the Jane Goodall Research Center at USC, and his latest book is Planet Without Apes. So let's talk about coltan, the very vital mineral that's used in a lot of electronics. And I don't think you can talk about this without talking about the kind of domino of wars that have gone on, starting with the Rwanda genocide against where the Hutu killed the Tutsis. The Tutsis reinvaded, drove the Hutu into the Congo. And ever since then, you've had that entire region destabilized, and you've got this warlord, Joseph Kony, mixed in with it. So you have all of this this mayhem going on, but it must impact the wildlife. Because you got all these guys in the jungle with AK-47s.
Right, yeah, and tragically, the last remaining population of some of the eastern gorillas are right smack in the middle of all this chaos that goes on in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. And coltan, as you mentioned, which is a nickname for an ore that's properly called columbite tantalite, is essentially a conflict mineral caught up in all of this. It's an ore that is used in your miniaturized electronic device, like your smartphone. Anybody walking around with a smartphone, which we all are now, is carrying some of this material with them, and we're kind of subsidizing this entire industry. 80% of the world's coltan supply is mined in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The mining itself is very destructive to the ecosystem. It very much resembles California gold rush mining of rivers and streams. It basically destroys those ecosystems. The camps of the miners, who were basically regarded as slave labor, bring their own problems, everything from disease, prostitution, and so forth. And as you mentioned, this material then is a conflict mineral, not quite as valuable as gold or diamonds, but nevertheless, you have generals from the neighboring countries around Congo acting as warlords. They want to be there. They want to be mining this coltan. It's very valuable, and its sale enables them to buy more weapons. It lines their pockets. So it's a very destructive, kind of vicious cycle, and the guerrillas are caught right in the middle of it.
So we've heard about blood diamonds and efforts to stigmatize blood diamonds, the very nature of that term does. So what about efforts to stigmatize coltan and make the American consumers who addicted to their iPhones realize that there's blood on the hands of this mineral? That
would be great. And the difficulty is that other than recycling your phone when you're done with it, which we all should do, it's hard to know what the average consumer can do to make an impact other than raising awareness. When PlayStation 3 was released, the global price of coltan doubled overnight. So this is an ore, it's not as valuable as diamonds, but it's an ore that has significant global value. Most of it's sent to China, of course, for use in factories where they then ship the phones to us. But it's a difficult practice to change because it's a booming economic engine in that part of the world, and it's a mostly illegal engine, and then it's not mined under the auspices of any particular body.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Stanford, who is the co-director of the Jane Goodall Research Center at USC. And we're talking about his latest book, Planet Without Apes. And we're live from the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books on the campus of the University of Southern California. So there's also the Ebola affecting. How does these diseases affect these endangered species?
Right, well, this is sort of ironic because Hollywood, of course, here we are sitting in LA, not far from Hollywood. Hollywood loves Ebola. They love, you know, the movie industry loves to make movies about these sort of plague level diseases, when the reality is that Ebola, the numerous outbreaks that have happened in human villages in Africa, have tended to kill a quite small number of people, and then they burn, and then the disease burns itself out, goes away. No one knows what we haven't nailed down what the vector is. We think that it may be bats, but we're not 100% sure of that. And then it goes away till it pops up again. But with respect to the great apes, for whatever reason, the epidemiology is different. And we know from censuses that 5,000 to 10,000 gorillas and chimps have died in the past 5 to 10 years, we find their carcasses all across the rainforest of Central Africa from Ebola. And so that's one of the great tragedies, that we all worry about it as a human plague, when in fact it primarily exists as a plague on these animals that number only in the thousands these days, when we number in the billions.
So, but one of the great apes that's endangered is the orangutan, and they're not in Africa. They're in Indonesia, are they not?
Correct, right.
Well, Borneo.
Right. In Southeast Asia, Sumatra and Borneo, yes, yeah. And so they're a different situation. What we've been saying up to now mainly applies to the African apes, the chimp, bonobo, and the gorilla. The orangutan's problem is that it lives in a country, Indonesia, that it's a developing country, but a rapidly developing country that has major natural resources that it is hell-bent to extract and use. So deforestation, destruction of the Indonesian rainforest is happening at an absolutely incredible pace. And the Indonesian government, although on the surface willing to work with global conservation community to in some way set aside land and protect the animals in that forest, they're pretty hell-bent on developing that forest. And most of the wood is going to either chopstick industry in the Far East. The land itself is then turned into palm plantations, because most of the world's palm oil, cooking oil, comes from Indonesia. And so it's turned into habitat that's absolutely useless to orangutans. There only are maybe 20,000, 15 to 20,000 orangutans left between Borneo and Sumatra. They cannot withstand any level of deforestation, and they reproduce more slowly than any of the other great apes. Maybe a female orangutan has a baby every 7 to 8 years. So they honestly can't withstand that level of deforestation. It's happening very rapidly. And I really wrote the book after many years of doing research on the great apes. I wrote the book because these problems are not, they're not in the category of, oh, gee, if we don't do something in our grandchildren's lifetime, they won't be there. It's more like in our own lifetime, they won't be there.
And what are the figures of silverback gorillas, for example?
The mountain gorillas that maybe you're thinking of exist in two tiny populations in East Central Africa, and the total is about 800 animals right now.
800?
Well, actually, 800 sounds like a terribly bleak number. It's actually growing rapidly because ecotourism, and maybe some listeners have been to Africa on safaris, and most African safari travelers want to include on their itinerary a visit to the mountain gorillas. It's a lifetime bucket list achievement. And as a result, those animals are worth more alive than dead now. And that's been a huge savior of the gorillas, because people now in the neighboring villages respect these animals, and they know that saving them, protecting them, will help them in that a portion of tourist money goes to pay for teachers, hospitals, doctors, and it enriches their own lives.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Craig Stanford, and for alerting us to the almost extinction of our closest relatives in the animal kingdom.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Craig Stanford, a well-known authority on the behavior of primates and other animals and on the biological and cultural roots of human behavior. He's a professor of anthropology and biological sciences at USC and director of the USC Jane Goodall Research Center. And he's the author of the new book, Planet Without Apes. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about a new book that exposes the power and corruption of Big Pharma, Blood Medicine, the man who blew the whistle on one of the deadliest prescription drugs ever. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kathleen Sharp, who's a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Parade, Elle, and Fortune, among many other publications. She has won 6 awards from the Society of Professional Journalists, among other honors, and she lives in Santa Barbara, California. And I take it you listen on, what is it, 98.7, is
well,
it?
Well, we listen, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kathleen. And your new book, Blood Medicine, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. As I mentioned in the opening, it's about the power of Big Pharma and their ruthless pursuit of corporate profit at the expense of innocent people and patients. And I also mentioned the role, or the lack thereof, of the Justice Department, whose current head is a former partner in the law firm who defended the villain in your book, Blood Medicine, Johnson & Johnson. So recently, just to touch on that, recently, wasn't there a special something that slipped into the must-pass spending bill that helped Amgen?
Right. And Amgen, of course, is the maker of the drug EPO that this book revolves around. But it's not just Amgen. It's Johnson & Johnson. They were one of the executives there, were one of the first people inside the White House when Obamacare was being formed 3 years ago. What you find is the pharmaceutical companies are very, very great at lobbying and sort of forming bills and getting handouts and entitlements that very few of us get. And what I loved about working on this particular book is that it was sort of an intimate tale of two star salesmen who for years and years sold this miracle drug that was EPO. And it was the first biotech blockbuster, and it never ever claimed to cure any disease. All it did was multiply your red blood cells so that you didn't have to take blood transfusions.
And it, but has it, didn't it attract people like the disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong?
Indeed it did. In fact, what this first biotech blockbuster did is it multiplied your red blood cells so much that you could climb alpine mountains, as the Tour de France bicyclist did, or you could fight chemotherapy. And of course, chemotherapy really robs your body of the white and red blood cells, but people who could get an injection of this at about $4,000 a shot could suddenly feel strong enough to undergo the toxic treatment that people have to endure for to beat cancer. So that's what the whole drug was. It didn't claim to cure cancer, but it just made you strong enough, allegedly, so you could go through it. But actually, what happened is that this drug was never tested accurately back in 1989. It wasn't tested in the larger patient population pools. So very slowly, they discovered that it not only multiplies your red blood cells, it multiplies your cancer cells. So that people who were hoping to be cured of this horrid disease were actually dying from it. 10 to 17% of the millions and millions of people who were taking it, in fact, died from either heart attacks or strokes. And Lance Armstrong, our disgraced hero, is really quite lucky that he didn't die from an overdose of this drug.
So just to finish up, though, on how Big Pharma has its grip on the Congress, to my mind, there's no other way to make the kind of money that Big Pharma makes from buying a politician. Say you buy a senator for, you know, $10,000. Let's be generous and say you pay $1 million for it.
Well,
and they don't do that, but they get them for tens of thousands. You get back, if you can get a rider in a bill to extend the patent on a drug that you have, you can make billions. Well, so the ratio between what you bribe a politician with and the profit you make is unbelievable.
That's right. In fact, I'm kind of ashamed that our congressmen and senators don't up the ante a little bit. Because in this particular case, Amgen and Johnson & Johnson earned $100 billion over 20 years because Medicare and Medicaid paid for this drug. Not, and to some extent, private insurers, but you and I, as taxpayers, paid collectively $100 billion for a drug that really never worked and really doesn't claim to cure cancer. So it's an astonishing, I mean, really an astonishing black art of lobbying that these two companies perform.
And again, I'm speaking with Kathleen Sharp about her new book, Blood Medicine, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. So let's talk about The Man Who Blew the Whistle.
His name is Mark Duxbury, a very charming salesman. And he was actually a star salesman at J&J who was selling this drug because he really believed that it was helping people. And he'd crisscrossed the Pacific Northwest and began to compete with a good buddy of his down in Tucson. And between the two of them, they kept trying to outsell one another until 5 years or so into their job, they realized that what they're being asked to do is actually quite crooked. They were being asked to pay doctors, oncologists, and nephrologists a few tens of thousands of dollars for speaking engagements or to fly to Hawaii for a weekend resort in order to talk up Procrit or Epogen, as the two brands are called. They were also starting to give these doctors free drug, knowing that they would turn around and bill Medicare and Medicaid for tens of thousands of dollars. And at one point, Mark Duxbury says, "Whoa, you know, boss, I'm not going to do this anymore." And as soon as he started to dig in his heels is when his career started to fall. He had a nervous breakdown at one point. He wasn't able to pay his mortgage. He lost his marriage. He lost his daughter. And he realized what he's got to do is, he was a very stubborn man, and he realized that he was going to start blowing the whistle. But he was very naive, dear Mark. And so what he did is he actually contacted a board of directors on J&J's board, and he didn't get anywhere there. And he came to realize that Johnson & Johnson, one of the most beloved companies in this country, the maker of baby shampoo and Band-Aids, was actually not living in a very, or not acting in a very ethical way, even though they claimed all these, you know, decades to be doing so. So he blew the whistle. He contacted Congress, and yet no one there would listen to him. And that's when I got a phone call in 2004. And he was up in Seattle, and I was down here in Southern California, and the tale he told me was too incredible to be true. I couldn't believe that, you know, the makers of Band-Aid and No More Tears shampoo was actually deliberately shooting up patients with high doses, unapproved high doses of a dangerous drug. It was like, no, I'm not going to do this story.
And ripping off the taxpayer to the tune of billions.
Billions of dollars. 30 billions, he claimed, at least in this case. But over the years, Mark would call every 3 or 4 months and, you know, tell me a few jokes and spoon-feed me sort of the details of Pharmacology 101. And I began to understand. And then in 2007, what happened is that Congress was holding hearings on the very fast practices, sales practices of J&J and Amgen. And the FDA was slapping a black box warning on the drug. So I got on a red eye and flew to Washington, D.C., and saw right in front of me this national scandal unfolding, both in Congress and at the FDA, and I realized, aha, here is a great story I can tell from the eyes of two good friends who happen to be star salesmen. And that's when I realized I had to move ahead with this story.
And didn't it end up in the Supreme Court? I mean,
It has been, but here's where it is right now. I thought, as perhaps many of your listeners might think, that if the government realized they were being ripped off by billions and billions of dollars, they'd take some action.
Right. Well, naive you.
Oh, very naive. Yes, I remembered my sixth grade civics class, right. But it doesn't quite operate like that today. It's been 10 years that Mark has been in federal district court with this case, and he's lost one appeal, and then it was overturned. Johnson & Johnson has appealed the case to the Supreme Court, but right now what's happening is that I'm going back to Boston in June to watch J&J try to prevent Mark Duxbury's case from going any further.
What's the case in a brief summary?
The case is blowing the whistle on this fraud. It claims that Johnson & Johnson, for years, was illegally shooting up people with an unapproved high dose, 33% higher, and was defrauding, was billing and teaching doctors and hospital chains and pharmaceutical chains how to bill for that high dose. And then was ripping us off of about $30 billion. Yeah. Now, this is not new with Johnson & Johnson. They've just recently settled a case with another drug called Risperdal. They've had numerous, they're in court right now on the hip recalls, the hip replacement. They've had numerous recalls of Motrin, baby Tylenol, 50 drugs in the last few years. So this is a company with a big black eye, but it's no different than Merck or GlaxoSmithKline, Pfizer, which have also paid high fines for the exact kind of thing that we're talking about.
So Kathleen Sharp, having done this book that's sort of like a detective thriller in a way, and Blood Medicine, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever, this happens all the time, because I do often interview whistleblowers, and you say, thank God for whistleblowers, but boy, do they always get shafted.
Oh, they do.
Isn't it amazing? Yes. You wonder why anybody does it.
You do, and I don't think they understand what they're going into when they initially start this process. I've talked to many, many people who've lost their houses, their marriages, and some have even died waiting for justice to be done. But what I love about this book is the sort of spirit of these two men. It's not all bad. To watch them go through the motions of trying to ring the bell for us nationally is really inspiring. Right. And I'm quite happy, actually, that Hollywood just has not only bought the film rights to the book, but they've hired two great screenwriters, Adam Cooper and Bill Collage, to write it. And they've gotten Ali Sheer, who is the producer of The Bourne Identity, to kind of ride herd on this project.
Wow. So, well, but what attracts me about it is, and would work in a movie, is that they're not your typical bleeding heart liberals. These are salesmen, for God's sake. They're at the heart of capitalism.
That's right. And one of them is very, very conservative down in the, near Phoenix, Arizona.
Right. Well, it has some echoes of that film with Russell Crowe about the tobacco industry.
Exactly. Right? The Insider. Yes, that's right. And in this case, Russell Crowe character, who was very high up, our two men were pretty high up. And the beauty of this book, from a journalist point of view, is that one of the characters, Mark's good friend, Dean McClellan, had warehouses full of documents of every deal he'd done. He had pictures of the doctors that he'd sent to Hawaii. His arm was around the CEO of the company,
there's a really solid paper trail here.
Right,
But of course, who's paying for their lawsuit against the endless coffers of J&J?
Well, great question. In whistleblowing cases, the men do not, and the women who defend these people, do not get paid until they get money for the public. And once they get the billions of dollars back from this fraud, then they're allowed to take maybe 10% of that reward. But the wonderful thing in this particular case is that Jan Schlickman, who was the character in another wonderful book called A Civil Action, is the crusading attorney who's defending Duxbury in this case. So he's not a guy that easily gives up.
I see. Well, so what's your sense then of whether I mentioned our Attorney General Eric Holder being in the law firm that defended the villain in your book Blood Medicine, Johnson & Johnson. A lot of people, of course, have been puzzled about how nobody from Wall Street's gone to jail.
Yeah.
And people wonder about what's wrong with the Attorney General, what's wrong with the Justice Department, and why aren't they standing up against these predators in corporate America. Do you have an answer for that?
Well, I think there's a revolving door that would make your head spin. It goes so quickly. Covington & Burling is the white shoe law firm in Washington, D.C. that defends Johnson & Johnson and does in this case. And yet one of the big partners in that firm was Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer, who perhaps from the headlines of the Wall Street scandal.
Sure. Well, that very good Frontline special, too, on why nobody's gone to jail, asking the question, why nobody's gone to jail for Wall Street.
And the answer is
Lanny Brewer.
Right, right. And he said, we're not going to prosecute the banks. Right. And the same thing Eric Holder is saying, we're just not going to prosecute a lot of these cases. And when they do prosecute, they only do it for pennies on the dollar. So right now we have about $300 billion in fraud a year in our healthcare system. And if we had a more vibrant Department of Justice and a big cop in the land, I think we would be able to get a lot more money back to help the orphans or the older people or all of us that really need legitimate healthcare.
Well, that kind of money, $300 billion?
A year in fraud and waste.
That is a huge part of the burgeoning cost of healthcare, isn't it?
It is indeed. And it's very easy to cut back on that simply by prosecuting these crimes and putting some executives behind jail.
Right. And they know what they're doing, right?
They're literally on
the government, I can't use the word, memory gland.
Well, they're in and out of those offices, either as the top cop of the land or on the other side of the defense bar.
Right, but they got, didn't they milk the government for $30 billion in this case?
That's allegedly, J&J? That's right, yeah, even though the drug really doesn't work as advertised. Right. But you also, I think there's becoming a lot more awareness, and that's why I'm really, you know, delighted about these men and what they're doing. Americans are understanding that they're being squeezed, you know, not just with the bank fees, but with healthcare fees and the high pharmaceutical prices. So there's going to be a tipping point where people are going to say, enough, basta.
So, but unfortunately, where are the heroes in this? Your guys are the heroes, and we'll be inspired by this film as we were by the Insider. But, you know, where are the heroes on Capitol Hill? Where are the heroes in the Congress? I mean, I guess Henry Waxman's done a pretty good job. But
yeah, and there's, you know, Bernie Sanders. We have a lot of we have quite a few people who are fighting the good fight. Mm. But unfortunately, they don't have the big megaphones. And again, I just, the more I talk about this book across the country, I hear people being really outraged at what is going on with our government. And there's a huge effort, I think, to take it back. So there's a lot of heroes. They may not be on Fox and Friends, but they're out there.
Well, you've obviously done a great service here with your book, Kathleen Sharp.
And, thank you.
And I hope that I can't wait to see the movie, frankly.
Well, me neither.
Yeah, well, let's not get into the vagaries of Hollywood.
Right, and anything could happen. Right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, but so far so good. So thank you, Ian.
Well, it's been a pleasure to meet you, and thank you so much for your book. Again, Kathleen Sharp, the author of Blood Medicine, The Man Who Blew the Whistle on One of the Deadliest Prescription Drugs Ever. And she is a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Parade, Elle, and Fortune, among many other publications. She has won 6 awards from the Society of Professional Journalists, among other honors. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Monday at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. And, of course, Brittany Gallagher and Brandon Barnard, Barney. Again, Brittany Gallagher and Brandon Barney, without whom this program would not have happened, and I'm deeply grateful to you both.